thanks to the deliberate policies of energy producers. From a climate perspective, more oil and gas production is not to be cheered, but the oil and gas industry has little incentive to shrink the fuel supply due to the climate crisis and wouldn't raise prices for that reason. Instead, the industry is likely manipulating costs because gas prices typically have little effect on demand and are not likely to drive down usage. This also means that middle and lower income people with few alternatives for transportation will be hurt the most by these prices as they continue to experience high levels of hardship nearly 2 years into the pandemic. Accountable.us wrote in its report, as Americans make sacrifices to cover high gas prices, oil and gas corporations are raking in billions that they then use to shower mega-rich CEOs and shareholders with more money. Rather than increase production or reinvest to meet the energy demand increase caused by the world re-emerging from COVID-19 lockdowns, oil and gas companies are taking advantage of bloated prices, fleeing American families along the way. The Biden administration has taken note of oil and gas companies' increased profits. The oil and gas companies are not flipping the switch as quickly as the demand requires, Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm said. Last month, Biden asked Federal Trade Commission to examine potential anti-consumer behavior by the industry, pointing out that the discrepancy between high prices and low wholesale cost, this unexplained large gap between the price of unfinished gasoline and the average price at the pump is well above the pre-pandemic average. The industry's actions regarding natural gas prices also lend credence to the idea that the companies are acting deliberately to pad their pockets. Recent reporting found that energy companies were exporting record amounts of natural gas while the limiting supply domestically ahead of the winter, as utilities are stocking up. Gas bills are projected to rise to 30% higher than last year, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. Senator Elizabeth Warren pushed energy companies to explain their exporting practices last month, criticizing their corporate greed. The cause of rapidly rising energy prices for consumers and manufacturers is clear. Some of the nation's largest and most profitable oil and gas companies are putting their massive profits, share prices, and dividends for investors, and millions of dollars in CEO pay and bonuses ahead of the needs of American consumers and the nation's recovery from the pandemic, Warren wrote in a letter to the nation's largest natural gas producers. The oil and gas industry isn't the only industry taking the advantage of the American public to pad their pockets during this month of economic turmoil. Corporations have seen huge increases in profits this year, which consumer advocates say is because companies are exploiting media cycles about inflation to raise prices precipitously. Midstream.
Saudi open media and political war against Lebanon was cruel, incomprehensible, and was not proportionate with the act of freedom of speech expressed by a Lebanese minister before he even took office. As a Lebanese whose freedom of speech is as sacred for her as her right for resistance, I say it was not Saudi Arabia's place nor right to push Lebanon to the brink of collapse only because it was denied access to meddle in Lebanese internal affairs. It was never about former Minister George Qardahi, who opted to resign on Friday in hope to rid his country more Saudi unnecessary fury. For more than two decades, the man was the son of Saudi Arabia and its crowned TV star, since the Arabic version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire jump-started Qardahi's fame. As for attributing Qardahi to the so-called Iranian axis of resistance in an attempt to brand him as a man of Hezbollah is nothing short of the usual Saudi illusion. The same illusion that keeps parroting at every corner that Lebanon is under the rule of Hezbollah. Ah, yes, Lebanon is under the rule of Hezbollah, but it was Saudi Arabia that kidnapped the Lebanese Prime Minister Saad al-Hariri in 2017 and forced him to resign on national Saudi TV. And it was Saudi Arabia that pushed for the resignation of former Foreign Minister Sharb al-Wehbi a few months back for having a televised feud with one Saudi political commentator, not even an official, over the role of Saudi Arabia in creating, funding, and supporting Takfirist terrorists like Daesh. And it was Saudi Arabia who launched a Persian Gulf political war against Lebanon and threatened to kick out every Lebanese citizen working in the Persian Gulf states simply for the truth that was blunted out by a non-official on a TV show about the absurdity of the Saudi war on Yemen. Yes, it is Hezbollah that rules over Lebanon. The same Hezbollah that has had his people killed in the streets of Beirut a couple of times by the Lebanese army itself, and other times by militias and thugs allied with Saudi Arabia and funded by it, but never retaliated with even one bullet. To name a few, Tayuni massacre, Khalde massacre, Marim Khayl massacre, and Airport Bridge massacre. If it were the case for real that Hezbollah controls Lebanon's political and official narrative, Western powers and their regional puppets like Saudi Arabia would have never missed the chance to summon the cavalry and attack the country to liberate Lebanon. The usual Saudi exaggeration in the way it deals with Lebanon in such a patronizing manner was a big error this time. Attacking everyone, even their royal servants in Lebanon, and threatening to kick their families out of the Persian Gulf made more way for Hezbollah to come out as the more concerned party for Lebanon's future, its upcoming parliamentary elections, and perhaps also its next presidential election. Mind you, at the time, the PGCC was punishing all of Lebanon when it needed their help the most due to the dire economic situation. Hezbollah was, and still is, oh the horror, listen to this, securing fuel for the people at subsidized rates from the Islamic Republic of Iran, securing free medical aid for the people, and providing food items at very low prices. Yeah, horrifying. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Lebanon did not need the crisis that Saudi Arabia provoked under the pretext of a statement by Minister of Information George Qardahi about the war in Yemen to ensure that the mentality of humiliation is rooted in most Lebanese political factions, especially towards Riyadh and its Persian Gulf neighbors. Since the beginning of the PGCC escalation, these factions have seen no solution but to offer Qardahi as a sacrifice to gain the long-lived approval of the Al Saud family and their cohorts by dismissing him or even forcing him to resign, sometimes by encouragement, other times by intimidation. And after a month of arbitrary and escalatory steps taken by Saudi Arabia and those in its orbit against Lebanon, Lebanese Information Ministry resigned on Friday, making way for unlimited future intimidation against any Lebanese official who dares to have a free mind. To discuss this issue with us from London is Hadi Nasrallah, political commentator, and no, he's not the son of you-know-who. Thank you for being with us, Hadi, very much for your time and contribution. Now, after a month of escalations by Saudi Arabia and its regional puppets against Lebanon, upping the ante against Hezbollah and the persistence of the Minister of Information on his position to refuse to resign from his ministry. We did see Qardahi submit his resignation last week. What happened that made Qardahi back down from his original position?
Thank you for having me again to discuss Qardahi's recent disappointing decision to resign amid the pressure that he's been receiving, not just nationwide in Lebanon. He's been receiving massive pressure internationally. And his recent decision was, let's say, that the last nail in the coffin of his decision was the French involvement, the French regime involvement in Lebanon. They've been recently having talks with the Saudi regime, and I think they used Qardahi as a sacrifice point, as a sacrifice card, to please the Saudis amid their future maybe agreements or future plans in the region. I would just want to state that he didn't receive that much support in Lebanon. I mean, of course, the resistance base was very supportive, and Hezbollah in general was supportive, but they didn't get involved directly to back him, and I don't think they can do anything much when it comes to that. But when you have, Qardahi is also a Lebanese minister, and Lebanese ministers always fall under political leadership, and that political leadership always have some sort of connections to foreign powers. Unfortunately, his party in that case is linked to the French regime and is not that hostile towards the Gulf regime, so they would allow to sacrifice one of their men for regional agreements.
Mm-hmm. Well, Hadi, as of last week, we have now two Lebanese ministers who have resigned from Lebanon's government in less than 1 year over their opinions about Saudi Arabia. After we had one Lebanese music composer also was kidnapped for more than a month and imprisoned in Saudi Arabia for his opinion, his simple opinion about the kingdom. And we have 4 years ago, the prime minister, almost 4 years ago, the then prime minister Saad al-Hariri was also kidnapped, and he was pushed to resign on Saudi national TV. Can you explain to us how such events in Lebanon are actually being run by Hezbollah, which is being occupied by Iran? I mean, don't they even hear what they are saying?
I mean, those are great examples you just said, and there's a lot more if we're going to keep digging. I mean, just a few days ago, there's one of the main Lebanese newspaper, they shared an offensive cartoon of the Iranian religious leader, who's a spiritual leader to many Lebanese people, and still there was no consequences whatsoever. If that the same thing was done to, I'm not going to say religious leader, just any political leader in the Gulf, that would open the gates of hell on that newspaper. And Hezbollah members have been killed recently in many areas. They've been ambushed in many areas, and still there was no consequences. And the people who are the perpetrators of those attacks are being released from jails right now. And that was mentioned by Hezbollah leader the other day. So I don't understand this rhetoric that Lebanon is under Iranian occupation. I mean, that should be, let's say, said that that's the worst occupation in the history of occupations in Lebanon, and we've been through a lot. But this is not innocent. They know that they can't fix that term that much, but it's been used to belittle actual occupations in Lebanon, which is the U.S. influence that's now building one of the largest CIA outposts in Lebanon, aka an embassy. And the Israeli occupation, of course, that is still occupying our Lebanese territories and use aggressing us militarily in the ocean, in the sea, by plane. And so they want to belittle that aggression.
Well, Hatifa, there's an apparent new French role here, which was supposedly key in pushing for Qardahi's resignation to acquire some sort of a negotiating card with the Saudis. Otherwise, the French president said that the Lebanese file will not be on Macron's agenda when he visits Saudi Arabia. Now, last time I checked, Lebanon became independent from the French mandate in 1943, or has it here? I mean, what on earth can Lebanon ever benefit if it loses all control over its internal political decision-making process here?
I mean, if anyone still believes that Lebanon gained independence from the French, they're just kidding themselves. We never gained our independence from the French. Maybe they left physically, but they were still grabbing us with their influence, putting their teeth right into our government system. I mean, the system that we still thrive on today in Lebanon is French orchestrated, and it's always going to be linked to the French regime and the French influence. The fact that there's direct intervention from the French, the Gulf, the Americans, and they're not even hiding it anymore. I mean, look at the U.S. ambassador right now. She keeps talking about arming the Lebanese army, or she talks about forming government or a crisis a group, and a lot of foreign intervention that's basically financially, politically, economically. They just instantly put de facto sanctions, and no one talks about it. But they just want when Iran literally does nothing. They don't say anything about anything. They just, for example, they give weapons, or they try to influence. Tell Hezbollah you can do whatever you want when it comes to government dealing with other regions. Instantly, Iranian occupation. They don't talk about it. But I believe that the French are still colonizing Lebanon, even if it's indirectly.
Well, Hadi Kordahi felt that he had become, quote, almost alone, unquote. I actually agree with that, because Lebanese media close to the resistance reported that he had contacted Hezbollah and Parliament Speaker Birri, who has very good arms within the Lebanese government, who assured him that the decision is all his. If he wants to resign, he can, and they could respect his decision, and if he insists on refusing, they got his back. Was that position enough, or do you think that more would have been done to protect Kordahi?
It wasn't enough, but I don't think they could have done anything more than that. I mean, they still have a lot going on. There's a lot of accusations about Hezbollah influence in the country, even if it's not true. But I don't think they could have done anything more. They just stood by him, and they told him that they respect his decision, whether he wants to resign or not. So if they can't enforce their, let's say, their narrative on a minister that doesn't even belong to their political party.
Yes, they are being called the hegemonies of Iran in Lebanon. They are being called the people who run Lebanon.
Exactly. Unfortunately, I mean, this is not true at all. We've seen that through a lot of scenarios the past years, these 2 years alone. Just now, I think there's a pro-Hezbollah journalist who's going to be jailed because he exposed the government.
Yes, he's being actually tried by the Lebanese military court, which is something out of the ordinary, because he should be under the publications court rather than the military court. Well, it's going to be a couple of very wild months in Lebanon until the elections and also until we see what will happen with all this foreign intervention. I want to thank you very much, Hadi Nasrallah, political commentator, for joining us from London to talk about what happened to Minister Kordahi. Now, please stay tuned, because after this we will be talking about the Saudi mandate on Lebanon.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Well, it's no secret that Saudi Arabia is upset because it was unable to dominate the political decision in Lebanon despite the money it paid to its puppets in the country. The main reason for the current kingdom's fury is Saudi Arabia's failure to bear its losses in the region. So its aggression against Lebanon came as a reaction. The timing of the Saudi aggression on Lebanon was directly related to losing grounds in Yemen's Ma'rib, as it wants to divert attention from the battles there by imposing pressure on Lebanon, at a time when Riyadh should have apologized for its unjustified aggression against Lebanon. We see the kingdom working in an absolute opposite direction. Mohammed bin Salman has still not fathomed that no one can really threaten the Lebanese people in general, nor can they twist the arm of Hezbollah in specific. Maybe he doesn't really read history. Lebanon is not anyone's backyard. We in Lebanon choose to deal with Saudi Arabia in equality and as an independent country. And we do not accept anyone's interference in our government or our internal politics. But here's Saudi Arabia's mandate on Lebanon in this following report.
Saudi Arabia was apparently surprised by the Arab and international response of astonishment and disapproval of the kingdom's brutal stance towards Lebanon under the pretext of statements made by former Information Minister George Kardahi about the kingdom's absurd war on Yemen. This forced the Saudis to provide another justification for their position. They claimed it was, quote, Hezbollah's hegemony over Lebanon, end quote. This is what was stated by the Minister of Foreign Affairs of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia on October 31, 2021. Later on, the kingdom stipulated that the Lebanese government meet and issue a statement condemning Hezbollah. For what reason should they condemn Hezbollah, you may ask? Well, one simple reason. Actually, the biggest of all reasons. Hezbollah's resistance to Israel. Other reasons, like importing fuel from Iran to rid the public from oil monopolies and Hezbollah's support for Yemen's Ansarullah, could all be maneuvered around. But the resistance to the Israeli occupation is what bugs the kingdom the most. The Lebanese arena became the only political theater that the kingdom could use to display what remained of its influence in the region. It was defeated in Yemen militarily and politically. It was defeated in Syria as well, where its Takfiri role had evaporated amid the steadfastness of the Syrian Arab army. After that, the influence slipped into the hands of the Turkish occupation in the north and the American occupation in the east and northeast. This made the kingdom cry wolf in Lebanon, blaming its political impotence on Hezbollah and pointing fingers at none other than the Islamic Republic of Iran, while blatantly accusing the latter of, wait for it, occupying Lebanon. In a country where U.S.-controlled UNIFIL soldiers strolled the streets freely, U.S. spies turned diplomats make decisions on behalf of the Lebanese government, and the American influence grows by the day as their new imperial fortress of $1 billion U.S. dollars is under construction in Lebanon, one of the smallest countries in the entire region. The Saudi position towards Lebanon reveals its dismay and inability towards all actors in the Lebanese scene. There is no party in Lebanon today that draws the kingdom's attention and wins its confidence other than Samir Jaja, so it counts solely on him and thinks of him as her winning horse. Oh, the disappointment. The Saudis attempted to exert a series of political, diplomatic, economic, and media pressures on Lebanon until the election date. By doing so, it hopes to besiege Hezbollah, the only force in the region currently head-to-head with Israel. Make no mistake, if Lebanon shared a border with Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman would not have hesitated for a minute to launch a military attack on Lebanon, just as it did in Yemen, believing in the elimination of the Houthis, whom, according to the kingdom, are an arm of Iran, just as it views Hezbollah. With such an animosity that Saudi Arabia always shows towards Iran, one might think that there have been decades of war between them. But in reality, Al Saud are just an extension of the Zionist project in the region whose success has been halted by the presence of an allied forces of resistance led by the Islamic Republic of Iran, and no one denies it. However, what baffles the kingdom is the readiness of the natives in each of Lebanon and Yemen to give their lives while protecting their land, people, and above all, preserving the Palestinian cause.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Hamza Al-Khansa, columnist at Al-Akhbar newspaper. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Hamza. Now, with all the recent Saudi hegemony on Lebanon, along with its PGCC puppet regimes exerting the highest forms of political, economic, and media pressure on Lebanon, has Lebanon finally surrendered and maybe given up its dignity to please Saudi Arabia?
In the beginning, it's necessary to clarify the conditions of Lebanon since 2005 until today. As the successive authorities and governments in Lebanon are directly and publicly affiliated with the Western Alliance headed by the United States of America and its tools in the region, especially Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia today is the primary controller of Lebanon's foreign policy and of decisions that are supposed to stem from Lebanon's exclusive national sovereignty derived from national dignity. If the question is whether Lebanon has relinquished its dignity and sovereignty, Lebanon has not today, or what is known as Minister Kordahi's crisis, relinquished this sovereignty and national dignity. But basically, there is no concept in Lebanon related to sovereignty with regard to foreign policy or even the slightest detail in domestic policy except in one issue. That issue is the Lebanese resistance that repeatedly defeated Israel in every episode of confrontation. Other than that, the Lebanese sovereignty that the puppets of the West parrot morning and night, the same puppets who calls themselves the Sovereign Lebanese Coalition and raises the slogan of sovereignty, freedom, and independence, we see them today gathering in the tent of the Saudi ambassador, sitting on the ground and apologizing to the ambassador to please his regime back in Saudi Arabia.
Well, Mr. Hamza, Lebanon is suffocating at the moment while its people are under unprecedented distress, and the reason is known to everyone. It's the corruption and the torrent of sanctions by the U.S. Western and Persian Gulf blockade against Lebanon, a fact that a line of ambassadors and politicians and agents, the ones you were just now mentioning, and media as well, who are working to deny all these facts presented while propagating an Iranian occupation on Lebanon. Can you please kindly pinpoint to us where, in which areas is Iran actually occupying us, or at least confiscating our sovereignty, please, Mr. Hamza?
I mean, the Iranian occupation of Lebanon is the strangest occupation that humanity has known since the dawn of history. It's an invisible and useless occupation. Even Iranian planes that land at Beirut International Airport are prohibited from refueling in Lebanon for fear of the wrath of United States of America. It was Saudi Arabia that, in a few months, caused the dismissal of two ministers, a foreign minister and the minister of information in Lebanon. And it was Saudi Arabia that was visited yesterday by the French president, where the French president and the crown prince of Saudi Arabia issued a joint statement outlining the Lebanese internal policies acceptable to Saudi Arabia. And then it's said in the media that there is an Iranian occupation in Lebanon. The media in Lebanon, the parties, the activists, the social media influencers affiliated with Saudi Arabia are making a living from insulting Iran and insulting the factions allied to Iran. And no one can even stop them. Iran offered Lebanon aid to get it out of its stifling economic crisis. However, governments, ministers, and officials in Lebanon did not dare to just thank Iran or even accept to receive this aid. And yet, there are those who say that Iran is occupying Lebanon. The media affiliated with the West and Saudi Arabia are now competing with each other over who insults Iran the most and who insults Iran's symbols the most. And they compete to create a language of contempt toward Iran. Knowing that all of this is a source of livelihood for them and a source of approval for the Saudi regime over their actions.
But Mr. Hamza, the Saudi foreign minister had attributed the cause of the crisis with Lebanon to the domination of what he calls, quote, Iran's agents over the political system. And that Saudi Arabia actually aims by creating this crisis, he's saying that Saudi Arabia created this crisis for, again, I quote, Lebanon's leaders to wake up, to find a way that will restore Lebanon to its position in the Arab world, unquote. It's a simple Saudi wake-up call, Mr. Hamza. Why do you think the Lebanese people are being so much frustrated towards this call? How do you think the Lebanese leaders will react to this call that is inviting them to face off with the biggest political faction in Lebanon, Hezbollah?
The confrontation today is clear in Lebanon between Saudi Arabia and its ruling group on the one hand, and the resistance group headed by Hezbollah on the other. The main problem between Hezbollah and the leadership in Saudi Arabia is, frankly, as stated in your report at the opening of this episode, is the conflict between the Israeli enemy and the resistance in Lebanon. Today, Saudi Arabia is working directly to achieve the Israeli agenda through the gateway to the conflict between the resistance and the Zionist enemy. Saudi Arabia wants its proxies in Lebanon to confront Hezbollah, defeat Hezbollah, expel Hezbollah from the government, and pull them outside the political life in Lebanon. Saudi Arabia wants its agents in Lebanon to do what it has been unable to achieve in Yemen for 7 years now. They are unable to end the so-called Houthi situation, as Saudis call it. They are unable to support the so-called legitimacy of ousted President Hadi. This experiment that Saudi Arabia and the Arab Islamic Alliance failed to achieve after 7 years in Yemen. They want Prime Minister Saad Hariri, Samir Jaja, and Western-funded NGOs to achieve in the face of Hezbollah. To be clear, this is a losing battle in advance, and the evidence for the difficulty of this matter is the fate of Saad Hariri, who was expelled from the political life in Lebanon by direct order of Saudi Crown Prince, who accused Hariri of weakness and failure to put an end to Hezbollah.
Well, it definitely seems that the upcoming couple of months will be decisive ones for Lebanon in relation to the upcoming elections and to the new Saudi bickering with the Lebanese officials concerning Hezbollah. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Hamza Al-Khansa, columnist at Al-Akhbar newspaper, for joining us to talk about this matter. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight. Anxiety or depression was the most common of 9 core long COVID symptoms reported among 270,000 people recovering from coronavirus in the United States. We have prepared for you an article written jointly by Andrew Gregory and Sally Wheel. The piece is titled COVID, 37% of people have symptoms 6 months after infection. A new study suggests 1 in 3 people infected with coronavirus would experience at least one symptom of long COVID. Much of the existing research into the condition, a mixture of symptoms reported by people often months after they were originally ill with COVID-19, has been based either on self-reported symptoms or small studies. Now, researchers at the University of Oxford, the National Institute for Health Research, and the Oxford Health Biomedical Research Centre have shed fresh light on the scale of the problem after studying more than 270,000 people recovering from coronavirus in the United States. They found 37% of patients had at least one long COVID symptom diagnosed 3 to 6 months after infection. The most common symptoms were breathing problems, abdominal symptoms, fatigue, pain and anxiety or depression. The National Institute for Health Research, NIHR academic clinical fellow, Dr. Max Tackett, said, "The results confirm that a significant proportion of people of all ages can be affected by a range of symptoms and difficulties in the 6 months after COVID-19 infection." Dr. Tackett added, "Over one-third of patients were diagnosed with at least one of the long COVID symptoms between 3 and 6 months after their COVID-19 illness." According to the data from the US-based TriNetX Electronic Health Record Network, severity of infection, age, and sex affected the likelihood of long COVID symptoms. The study published in the journal PLOS Medicine showed long COVID symptoms were more frequent in those who had been hospitalized, and they were slightly more common in women. Different factors also influenced which of the symptoms people were most likely to experience. For example, older people and men had more breathing difficulties and cognitive problems, whereas young people and women had more headaches, abdominal symptoms, and anxiety or depression. The research found COVID patients admitted to hospital were more likely to suffer cognitive problems like brain fog and fatigue compared with people who did not need to be admitted. People who did not need hospital care were more likely to have headaches than those who needed to be admitted to hospital. The researchers said many patients had more than one long COVID symptom. Dr. Tackett said, "These data complement findings from self-report surveys and show that clinicians are diagnosing patients with these symptoms. We need appropriately configured services to deal with the current and future clinical needs." The study also looked at the same symptoms in people recovering from flu. The study suggests people who get flu can have prolonged symptoms similar to those seen in some patients with long COVID, but lasting symptoms occur to a far lesser extent in those who had influenza. The researchers estimated symptoms linked to long COVID were 50% more common among those who had COVID compared with those who had flu. Professor Amitabha Banerjee, Professor of Clinical Data Science and Honorary Consultant Cardiologist at University College London, who was not involved in the research, said it was a large, well-conducted and thorough study. He said the findings supported the calls that have been made for large-scale rollout of health services for those with long COVID, including those not hospitalized with COVID-19. Professor Banerjee said, "Over half of patients, or 57% of them, had at least one long COVID feature recorded in the 6 months after infection, and one-third, or 37%, in the 90 to 180 days after diagnosis." Professor Amitabha Banerjee stressed the study had limitations, such as the fact it had focused on the 9 symptoms probably most common among those with long COVID. However, because as many as 200 signs of long COVID have previously been suggested, the reported incidence of long COVID was actually likely to be an underestimate. He added that the fact the 9 symptoms were all more common after COVID-19 than for flu was yet another arrow in the quiver against bogus "this is just like flu" claims. Separate research published on Tuesday, 28th of September, found more than 1 in 10 secondary school pupils and over a third of school staff who had COVID-19 in England have suffered ongoing symptoms. According to the study from the Office of National Statistics, the most common symptom reported by staff and school pupils was weakness or tiredness, while staff were more likely to experience shortness of breath than pupils. Overall, the Office for National Statistics estimates that 970,000 people in the United Kingdom are suffering continuing symptoms after a COVID-19 infection. The figures, based on self-reported symptoms, also suggest 384,000 people are still living with symptoms a year after infection. Moreover, in recent months, long COVID has received a great deal of media and public attention. Research has found that as many as one in four of those infected with COVID, perhaps millions of people in the United States alone, suffer from chronic long-term symptoms, including headaches, dizziness, abdominal pain, heart problems, fatigue, anxiety, depression, cognitive impairment, and other conditions. It is a difficult and complex illness, and we must do much more to help those who are struggling with it. At the same time, it is important to realize that rather than being a strange special case, long COVID is probably part of a broader phenomena that affects many more people. In recent years, doctors and researchers have increasingly realized that many of those who survive an illness of any kind or who go through serious physical trauma are at high risk for a range of debilitating and chronic physical, cognitive and mental health symptoms, problems that closely resemble long COVID. Seen in this context, it's not at all surprising that many patients infected with COVID find themselves dealing with an array of persistent health problems. This is not to minimize long COVID in any way, but simply to put it in a broader context. The issue is in part a byproduct of a medical transformation. Over the past half century, as medicine has advanced, clinicians have learned how to save hundreds of thousands of severely ill or injured patients who would have previously died. This is a remarkable accomplishment. But in many cases, survival does not mean complete recovery. Some patients find that their bodies, brains, and psyches continue to bear the scars of what they have gone through. One non-COVID study found that a year after hospitalization, a third of patients with severe respiratory failure or shock had significant cognitive impairment. Another study found that between a quarter and a third of patients who were treated in the intensive care unit had significant and long-lasting symptoms of anxiety, depression, or post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. Researchers have found similar results for survivors of other medical conditions, including cancer, multiple sclerosis, and ALS. Unfortunately, people with long COVID, as well as other chronic post-illness symptoms, often find that the medical establishment doesn't understand their experience and so minimizes or questions it. This is not surprising. Clinicians tend to pay less attention to how patients with severe illness do once they're out of mortal danger or once symptoms extend beyond an arbitrary time frame. Researchers do not yet fully understand the physical causes of these chronic symptoms. It is clear that long COVID and long versions of other illnesses and injuries are not psychosomatic. These conditions have a psychological basis. Among the possible culprits may be persistent dysfunction in inflammatory or immune responses triggered by the initial illness or initial injury. In some cases, the disease or injury may also leave permanent damage, just as someone with a broken leg may end up walking with a limp. Contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
As the world is arriving upon the two-year mark for the ongoing global COVID-19 crisis, experts and health officials predict that the pandemic will improve significantly by sometime next year. Meanwhile, the new COVID variant Omicron has spread rapidly to the alarm of researchers worldwide. Of course, some of these predictions may prove accurate, but factors like the United States reopening businesses too soon this year, or similar miscalculations in pragmatic management of the crisis by other governments worldwide, could delay progress. So it all comes down to the basic fact that the sooner everyone gets vaccinated, the more likely we'll see improvement and get past the current crisis in the coming months. Well, it's easier said than done. For instance, inadequate vaccine distribution is still a major international problem, while vaccine hesitancy has been increasingly surfacing in different parts of the world. To find out about how competently Iran has managed the critical mission of responding to the pandemic thus far and the president's COVID-19 plan, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today, partly shot in Iran Mall, which has fashioned itself also into a vaccination center to help tackle the pandemic under supervision of the Ministry of Health. In consistence with given circumstances, Iran is currently bracing itself for the new wave of COVID-19 infections, even though its nationwide vaccination efforts have accelerated in recent weeks. Meanwhile, Iran's newly inaugurated president, Ebrahim Raisi, has taken the helm at an extraordinarily difficult time for the country. He has inherited two major challenges, a public health emergency and a sanctions-stricken economy. Dr. Haydari is health deputy to the health minister. He gave us some useful sound bites I'd like to share with you.
Aside from the international community's shocking response to the sanctions imposed on Iran, we've had the same issues concerning vaccines. Countries around the world were trying to safeguard their communities by vaccinating their population. Just like the sanctions, they did not respond well to Iran over the vaccines. Although Iran had paid for all of its vaccines in its basket, there were delays in the delivery of the jabs. This created an opportunity for our scholars and scientific groups to start their work on vaccine production.
Among the nations hardest hit by the coronavirus, it is Iran that has had to face off against the disease while also being targeted with some of the harshest and wide-ranging inhumane and illegal sanctions the U.S. has ever imposed on a country. To Raisi's aid, this country has one of the best medical and public health infrastructures in West Asia, exporting its cadre of physicians abroad for decades. However, despite frontline health workers' heroic efforts to save lives, it may be many months before the coronavirus is contained. Dr. Qanei is Scientific Committee Chief of the National Coronavirus Combat and Prevention Headquarters. Always a pleasure to hear him out.
The crisis ends when there are no patients in the hospitals or the death toll is on the decline. This is a scenario that the world has defined for the end of the pandemic.
This aligns well with Director General of the WHO, Mr. Tedros's prediction
that by vaccinating 70% of the population by the end of 2022, the COVID-19 crisis will end. Therefore, considering that our country is nearly done with the second dose of vaccination
and has managed to inoculate 75% of its population
and now is rolling out booster shots, we predict that the COVID-19 pandemic would be over in the early 2020 or before the Iranian New Year.
Iran has been one of the world's most severely affected countries by the pandemic. There have been more than 5 million cases of infection and 130,000 deaths in the country of under 85 million. Over 51,000 children have lost at least a parent to the COVID-19 pandemic, according to Iranian welfare authorities. It is feared the impact could be far-reaching. In the first year of the crisis, more than 1 million Iranians lost their jobs, as reported by Iran's Islamic Parliament Research Center. The government's reluctant-imposed lockdowns have also severely affected the economy, which was already struggling due to U.S.-led imposed economic sanctions, the fall in oil prices, and mismanagement. Rivalry, particularly by the U.S., has played a major role in hampering Tehran's ability in dealing with the crisis. Four sanctions have limited this country's access to medicine, health supplies, and funds.
No personal protection equipment was available, not even face masks. That was when all local workshops joined efforts to produce masks, coveralls worn by medical staff, environmental disinfectants, and others. Institutions and government bodies also helped procure the equipment. We faced a severe wave of infections but lacked ICU beds, ventilators, and other much-needed equipment. We also had a shortage of both basic and COVID-19 specific medicines, all of which was due to oppressive sanctions against Iran. In a matter of a month to a month and a half, we started producing everything, including ventilators, which are very advanced devices, and ICU beds.
In light of that, the United Nations Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet has urged the U.S. to relax sanctions on Iran and other countries for fear they contribute to the collapse of medical systems, contributing to the growth of the pandemic in neighboring countries. Both for global public health reasons and to support the rights and lives of millions of people in these countries, sectoral sanctions should be eased or suspended, she said in a statement. In a context of global pandemic, impeding medical efforts in one country heightens the risk for all of us.
Facilities were provided for more people to have better access to basic outpatient services, selected centers were formed, and throughout the country, our colleagues received the necessary training and were deployed. People in all geographical locations then had access to trained doctors, lab teams, and so on to avoid being hospitalized. This is one of our achievements. Before that, our diagnostic system had to be equipped. Hundreds of labs were equipped within a month with domestically made test kits.
In fact, scholars in the field of social sciences claim Iran has been able to take advantage of its social capital in mobilizing semi-governmental and popular institutions to fight the coronavirus. This has been a display of effective governance in triggering a sense of social responsibility to serve society and help medical staff. According to Stephen A. Cook, a senior fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies, West Asia is a region that has fragile public health systems and, in a variety of important cases, not a lot of resources in order to deal with the pandemic. Many of the countries in the region, after getting a slow start, have taken some prudent steps of varying degrees of effectiveness, like banning flights to and from certain countries, shuttering borders, instituting curfews, and doing their very best to marshal medical gear. But overall, like the United States, most of these countries have been relatively slow. We went to the health ministry, where its educational center chief, Dr. Rezai, explained before the interview how it's imperative to prevent virus transmission best we can, because it's by going from body to body that the virus recognizes human physiology and mutates into more dangerous strains that can infect everyone.
Depending on which country foreign travelers are coming from, we ask for a negative COVID-19 test or a vaccine certificate. Arrivals from designated red countries are banned, like South Africa, where a new variant has emerged. Arrivals from such countries are banned except for special cases. For example, an Iranian national who's working there and is coming back is regarded as a special case. But they are treated differently from arrivals from other nations.
Within the context of the region, Iran has a rather well-developed public health infrastructure in a sense that it has managed to have hospitals and clinics even in remote parts of the country. So unlike perhaps Iraq and others, it has had a firmer base to take off from in responding to the crisis. Indeed, dangerous COVID-19 infections are decreasing in Iran, given the public vaccination program has gained momentum with a hike in vaccine imports and the opening of round-the-clock vaccination centers.
We have vaccines in sufficient quantities and beyond the need for injection in our storage rooms. Some are still reluctant to receive their doses, but we hope we can overcome this challenge so the nationwide vaccination campaign can be completed. We plan to roll out booster shots by domestically made vaccines, considering the knowledge-based company's work in producing them.
For economic reasons, the country can't just remain in lockdown indefinitely, but restrictions have on occasion appeared somewhat haphazard, tight until just before holiday season, say, when people tend to burst out into bazaars and domestic trips. Still, the country is mostly blue now, which is good, corona-wise. This must mean we did something right, importing vaccines, probably. Whilst our teacher Dr. Rezai at the Health Ministry has some holiday precaution advice, he's optimistic the already effective nationwide vaccination program will yet pick up. International Volunteer Day, 5th December, is when we got to meet him, and that's just weeks before Iran's autumn festival season of the winter solstice, Yalda night.
We have more than 60 universities. Some of our provinces have several universities inside the province. About how many volunteers there are, I need to say that the spirit of voluntary work is diverse. The Red Crescent is training its volunteers. The same can also use the training provided by the Health Ministry. Volunteers could be members of the Basij organization. There are some 2 million student volunteers in Iran. We have about 1,200 volunteers in the seminary. It's hard to give an accurate figure, but we take pride in the number of volunteers, and we always welcome more people.
Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
Media reports indicate that Iran is fighting COVID-19 while also fending off a vicious and likely state-backed propaganda offensive. Well-organized operatives in exile spend their days spreading misinformation about the illness, trolling journalists and others who are struggling to separate fact from fiction. Across the internet, opposition operatives have forged documents and even faked audio recordings to exaggerate the effects of the pandemic and undermine public trust. Bad information on the internet about the coronavirus is already needlessly costing hundreds of lives, as was the case when some Iranians heeded advice in fake articles to drink ethanol in an attempt to ward off the coronavirus. There's plenty more to be said on Iran and the fight against coronavirus, but only after a quick diversion into world media.
Welcome. I am Mohammed Gourd, and I will be presenting to you this episode news section, where we will discuss what media had to say about COVID-19 in West Asia. Media from Middle Eastern countries, from Turkey to the Persian Gulf, have been focused on concerns about a new COVID variant called Omicron. Since the mutation's discovery in South Africa, many countries have taken proactive measures against it. Now, in December 2021, the Jerusalem Post has released a report titled, How Are Middle Eastern Countries Responding to the Variant? According to the report, the United Arab Emirates, along with Saudi Arabia, have restricted travelers from several South African countries. Egypt has raised the level of preparedness at quarantine departments at all land, air, and seaports. And that's according to the Ministry of Health. In Kuwait, Yusuf Al-Fawza, the Civil Aviation Department Director, confirmed that it sent a letter to the Association of Travel emphasizing compliance with all health requirements on all flights coming into the country. Meanwhile, Turkey appears to be taking the new variant in stride. However, the country has imposed a travel ban on five African countries, and that's according to a statement by Turkish Health Minister Fahrettin Koca.